Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOMLP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research, development, and innovation. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. Radio In Vivo is proud to acknowledge the underwriting support of our friend, Mr. Steve Brockman. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by Steve for the advancement of science and education. It's also a pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Conder of Carolina Neuropsychological Service of Raleigh and Chapel Hill. Bob provides neurocognitive evaluations and neurofeedback for sports concussions and optimal sports performance. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. This week on Radio In Vivo, we focus on the condition expected to soon overtake heart disease as our number one killer. That is, of course, cancer. As with so many afflictions, there are exciting developments being pursued right here in the Triangle as one biopharmaceutical startup company is working on a new therapeutic modality that is poised to revolutionize the treatment of cancer. That company is called Heat Biologics Incorporated, and they are located in Durham, close to Research Triangle Park. Heat Biologics was founded in 2008 based on the research work of Dr. Eckhard Podack from the University of Miami. The company went public in 2013. We have the pleasure today of welcoming Dr. Melissa Price to Radio In Vivo. She is Heat Bio's Vice President of Clinical and Regulatory Affairs. Prior to joining Heat Biologics, Melissa held a variety of positions directing oncology programs in both the biotech arena and the contract research organization space. She was an executive at Inc. Research, NovaQuest, a Quintiles company, and Attenuon, an oncology-based biotechnology company. Melissa holds a PhD in organic chemistry from Yale University. Melissa Price, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
As I mentioned, Heat Biologics is advancing an entirely new paradigm in the treatment of various cancers, an approach called cancer immunotherapy. And as we were talking about before we came on the air, recently PBS had a major three-part documentary series called Cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies, which was based on the best-selling book. And in the third part of that three-part series, almost the whole program was devoted to talking about cancer immunotherapy and what it is and where it's coming from. Now, we will discuss the concept and your company's specific approach, obviously, in great detail. But first, I'd like you to give us a quick education about what cancer immunotherapy is and how it differs from more traditional treatment modalities.
Sure, happy to. And actually, before I answer that, if I can just comment about your the Emperor of All Maladies.
So, sure.
Thinking about Dr. Mukherjee's book, one of the interesting things about the book is that every new cancer therapy has been met with resistance initially.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken a lot of effort and energy to actually convince people to give chemotherapy, for example, and to demonstrate that it actually does work.
Right. It was a fascinating history.
Yeah. And I think immunotherapy is no different. It's relatively new. People have been working on it for 20 years, but it's only recently been gaining some real traction. So, I think as human beings, we tend to stick with what we're comfortable with. And so immunotherapy has not necessarily been at the forefront, and the science is really evolving quickly, and people are really recognizing that there's a real opportunity here, and the data supports that, obviously. To answer your real question to summarize immunotherapy, a lot of people use an analogy of a car where your immune system can be like a car in the sense that you need both the accelerator to be pressed down for a car to move, and you also need the brakes of the car to be removed, or you can't go anywhere. And it's very similar with your immune system. So you need to put the accelerator down of your immune system, so ramp the immune system up, but then your body naturally puts up these barriers. You may be familiar with the term checkpoint inhibitors and checkpoint blockade, which is a real active clinical space right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to remove those as well. So it's sort of a two-part system. And I think because of that, really combination immunotherapies is likely the ultimate future of the immunotherapy space. And it's really exciting times.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Science Magazine named cancer immunotherapy as its 2013 breakthrough of the year, which is a huge recognition.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
It's not operating under the radar. It's
not anymore. Not anymore.
Well, can cancer immunotherapy, do you think, Melissa, live up to the hype that it has received in the past couple of years, especially since that recognition from science?
Certainly the data supports it.
Okay.
I can give you a couple examples. So ipilimumab in melanoma has striking response rates. Recently, nivolumab, both of these are checkpoint inhibitors, going back to what I mentioned before about taking the brakes off the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, a subset of patients respond, not all, but the patients that do respond quite well and have very durable responses, and that translates into a much longer and better quality of life for patients. So I think there's still a ways to go in the sense that we haven't cured cancer for all patients.
Sure.
Will immunotherapy alone be that ultimate solution? I think, the time will tell and the data will bear that out. But certainly it is without a doubt here to stay and will become a major a tool in the arsenal for fighting cancer. And I think it's going to differ for different patients. Different subsets of patients will require different combinations of maybe immunotherapy with radiation or immunotherapy with chemotherapy or multiple types of immunotherapy. So it's really not a one-size-fits-all approach, and patients are all different. And but I think being able to leverage a patient's individual immune system is certainly a huge breakthrough.
Absolutely. Well, one question I had in researching this topic was, we see so much immune-related disease.
Mm.
How do you approach this without, causing disease as opposed to curing it?
Yeah, it really depends on the mechanism of the individual agent with immunotherapies.
Mm-hmm.
In general, and I'm speaking very generally, immune therapy is less toxic than other standard therapy, certainly than chemotherapy.
Sure.
But they're not all without risks.
Mm-hmm. And so, that's why you test them so thoroughly.
Yeah,
right?
So that you understand what those risks are, you mm-hmm. can balance and make a decision for an individual patient. Is that potential risk worth the benefit for patients with, let's say late stage lung cancer? Is the risk of long-term endocrine disruption worth curing or maybe not curing, I shouldn't use that word, but
right.
Extending the duration of life? And a lot of patients, absolutely, the answer is yes. With CAR T cells, which have shown just striking responses in huge proportions of patients with hematologic malignancies, it has to be given in an ICU. Patients are often brought near death, but then they're cured. So, it's a great question, and I think it's really an individual patient question that you have to balance between what do we know about what does the agent do from a negative perspective versus what does it do from a positive perspective.
Mm-hmm. But many of these agents, including your companies, have already passed through the phase one questions about safety issues and dosing. So, hopefully they can be entering the marketplace without those concerns about, major side effects.
Yeah, and at least you know what you're getting.
Right.
What to expect and you know how to manage it. I mean, certainly, I think when chemotherapy was originally, started in terms of treatment of patients, physicians didn't know really how to manage those toxicities. And it's taken, mm-hmm. A lot of years to figure out how to manage the intense nausea and vomiting, hair loss, things that seem very easy to manage now and oncologists know how to manage.
Right.
We're learning how to manage a different set of toxicities that are associated with immunotherapies.
I see. Well put. Well, Melissa, when did it really start to emerge that cancer is in large measure a disease of the immune system and that the immune system itself can be harnessed to combat it?
I don't know if you could pinpoint a particular moment in time when people started thinking about this, but there's been work done for many, many years. In fact, the work that our technology at HEAT is based on has been studied not scientifically and then not outside the clinic, preclinically,
mm-hmm.
for 15 or so years. So, I think science evolves slowly, but I think people have certainly over the last 10 to 20 years really started to understand that cancer has a large immune component.
And this was really a revolutionary concept when it first started taking a look at it, wasn't it?
Absolutely. There's a lot of detractors. And I think, if you were to ask our CEO, in fact, when he initially was interested in this technology and was going to talk to investors about funding this, people said, targeting your own immune system to kill cancer, I don't believe it. There was a lot of pushback and resistance that, even though the data, people have been working on it for many years and the data supports this, it is a different concept. It almost seems too good to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And times have changed. The data set is bigger and better, and data is what convinces people.
Absolutely. Well, could this approach eventually lead to a time when cancer becomes more like HIV is today, a chronic condition, and no longer a death sentence, as it were, for too many people? I know that's already true with some forms of cancer, but certainly not yet, at least with some others, such as mm-hmm. pancreatic or brain cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think yes. And I think, again, going back to the combination immunotherapy approach, I think it is going to be unique for each tumor type, potentially even for each patient, and mm-hmm. different combinations for those different tumor types. Certain types of immunotherapies tend to work in tumors that your immune system seems to already recognize. Melanoma, kidney cancer, for example, are good examples in terms of the checkpoint inhibitors, the CAR T cells in terms of hematologic malignancies. So it's not a one size fits all approach. And the low hanging fruit will obviously be the ones that are addressed quickest. I think as the science continues to evolve, we'll chip away at that and figure out what are the right combinations for each tumor type, and potentially even down to an individual patient's, epigenetics.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be very interesting to see, where we stand in, even just 10 years from now.
Couldn't agree more.
Absolutely.
10 years seems like a long time, but it goes by in a flash in this business.
Absolutely. Well, getting a drug to market from inception to commercialization and FDA approval is, I don't know if that calendar has changed too much, but common wisdom is that it's at least a 10-year enterprise.
Yeah, that in general is probably still true. Mm-hmm. I think for certainly some of these checkpoint inhibitors that I mentioned, nivolumab, pembrolizumab, also some non-immunotherapies like Imbruvica, had much shorter overall development timelines due to some recent changes at the FDA.
Okay.
So they have a new breakthrough status that really gets you, I hate to use the word shortcut because that almost sounds like you're not doing what you need to do, but it gets you in front of them. They work with you much more closely, collaboratively. And for things that are really, truly spectacular, the bar is a little bit lower.
Mm-hmm.
and rightfully so. If you've demonstrated that this is truly very safe compared to whatever's out there, that it truly does extend a patient's quality and duration of life, I think there's a real need for being able to get those out to patients in need quicker, and the FDA has responded in doing that in the last few years. So that's been a really great improvement, and a number of agents have taken advantage of that already.
Sure, that's great to know. And I know one of your agents in development just received FDA Fast Track status, and we'll get into that in a few
great.
Minutes.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Heat Biologics.
Sure.
Give us a quick thumbnail, Melissa, on the Heat Biologics approach to cancer immunotherapy, which
sure.
is known as the IMPACT platform.
Sure.
Which I'll spell it out for you. I know you could reel it off, but it's short for Immune Pan Antigen Cytotoxic Therapy. Now, there's a lot going on in that term, and I'm hoping you can unpack it for us.
Sure. Maybe we shouldn't even talk about the long name there and just talk about IMPACT.
Okay, that'll be fine.
So, basically, what our technology does is leverage, just like other immunotherapies, leverages the patient's own immune system. And so we're turning on basically a switch that already exists in your immune system. So cancer aside, when your cells are infected by a pathogen, say a virus, let's say, what normally happens is that cell explodes and a protein that's inside called GP96, which is responsible for folding basically every other protein in the cell, comes out of the cell, and that the presence of GP96 turns on this switch of the immune system that says to the immune system, okay, generate a bunch of killer T cells that are going to come kill anything that looks like all these proteins that are floating around, because this is not a healthy cell.
Mm-hmm.
This cell shouldn't be here. It's been infected with a virus. Go kill it. And so it's the mechanism of GP96 activating the immune system that turns on this immune switch. Now, what we've done is GP96 is normally stuck inside your cell. So it normally only turns on that switch of your immune system when that cell bursts, when it's infected with a virus, for example.
Sure.
And that's what turns on the switch. In our case, what we've done is we have generated whole cells that have a bunch of proteins that we believe are overlapping with the proteins in a patient's tumor cell. But those cells that we deliver pump out GP96. So you don't have to wait for those cells to open up to turn on the switch. They're pumping out that GP96 signal as soon as you administer those cells to patients. So you've got sort of the two-pronged approach where GP96 is pumping out and turning on that immune switch, which we haven't messed with that. That's nature.
Sure.
And your body does that anyway.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But then also it has that cargo of all those proteins to make it look like the tumor so that then the T cells are generated to come kill anything that looks like those proteins that we basically trained it to look for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it goes and kills the tumor. So that's the, in a nutshell, how the technology works.
I see. And where did this impact approach come from? How was it originally developed?
Yeah, so it was developed a number of years ago by Lloyd Old and I'm sorry, I can't remember the other person's name that did a lot of the early preclinical work, and was then developed ultimately by Eckhard Podeck at the University of Miami over many years.
Mm-hmm.
And really, Dr. Podeck's contribution, so the GP96 mechanism and how the immune system function was really the work of those early folks. What Dr. Podeck did was say, it was a piece around getting the GP96 to be secretable, and rather than it just relying on either, let's say, purifying GP96 and injecting that, to actually have a cell system pump it out. That was really his contribution there, among many others.
But which is a huge...
It's a huge advancement. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it you know, we've shown that having that cell-based system that pumps out GP96 is much more effective than just purifying the protein GP96, because that's a question we get often is, why don't you just give GP96?
Sure.
And the answer to that is you can't give it at a high enough concentration for most patients.
I see.
And you can't purify enough of it. So having the cell-based system is really the secret sauce there.
Indeed. Well, let me read you a quote about IMPACT and
sure.
the cell-based system and Heat Biologics' application of it, and kind of get you to elaborate a little
okay.
bit. This is IMPACT transforms allogeneic, which I'm going to get you to define
sure.
for our listeners, living cancer cells into powerful machines that continually secrete heat shock protein GP96. Reportedly the most potent mammalian adjuvant ever described, along with its chaperoned antigens. There's a lot going on there
yeah.
as well, but it's all just very interesting. My first question when I saw that statement was an obvious one, I think, to at least the layperson. You're injecting people with living cancer cells?
They are living in the sense that they are able to secrete GP96,
mm-hmm.
but they are not able to divide. So they've been irradiated so that they can't replicate in your body.
I see. Okay.
So that's a pretty important distinguishing
yes,
factor.
Indeed.
Yeah. But the reason why they are cancer cells is because they have that antigen repertoire that tells the immune system, this is what you need to go seek out.
So they have the red flags.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Define allogeneic, because that's a very important term in this discussion.
It's a very important term, and thank you for asking that. So the two terms when you're talking about, this is a form of a vaccine. The two terms are autologous and allogeneic. So autologous means that you are taking something from the individual patient, usually doing something to it in a lab, and then readministering it to the patient.
Mm-hmm.
The benefit of an autologous approach is that it's very personalized. The disadvantage to an autologous approach is severalfold. One is that you're obviously having to take something from the patient. That means in the case of a tumor vaccine, you have to be able to get enough tumor to extract whatever you need. It also means that you are manufacturing your agent at the patient level. So every single vaccine that you manufacture is personalized, which means that, you know, what happens if one thing goes wrong, that patient now doesn't have a vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
It also means it's very expensive to prepare because you have to do it every time. So there's quality issues and there's cost issues. And then there's, you know, patient inconvenience issues, you know, to have to extract, something from a patient. So that's the autologous approach.
Right. And I should mention that, some of the folks developing that are also here in the Triangle.
Absolutely.
And have been guests on the show before. And
have been very successful. And, you know, there's a lot of patients really benefiting from that.
Sure. So it has its place.
It really does. And you may be familiar with Dendreon's Provenge vaccine, which is on the market. That is an autologous vaccine and has gotten approved. So it's not to say that it's not doable. It's just different. It's pros and cons.
Indeed.
The allogeneic approach is, from a layman's perspective, off the shelf. So it means that you manufacture a lot of vaccine all in one batch or multiple batches, and then you just pick a vial off the shelf for a patient. And the reason why we can do that in this case is because we've chosen these cell lines that have such a broad range of antigens that we believe that it covers a heterogeneous patient population. So it's not that we have, let's say, one antigen and only 50% of the patients have that one antigen. It may be that, you know, we've got 50 or 100 antigens. There's some antigens that we don't even know about. And maybe patient one needs antigen 1, 3, and 5, and patient two needs 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And so you have this matrixed approach within a single product that allows you to have that broader coverage. So that's why we can, why we believe we can do an allogeneic approach. Mm-hmm. And then from a commercial perspective, the benefits of the allogeneic approach are obviously from a scalability of manufacturing perspective and a cost of goods perspective, you know, very attractive from that point of view.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I believe the biggest advantage you've got going for the allogeneic approach is that cost factor.
Yeah.
You know, I know the FDA is not allowed to consider cost in its deliberations, but we certainly can out here in the marketplace and in the in the clinical world. You know, some of these more recent innovations in pharmaceuticals, particularly the so-called biologicals, can be incredibly expensive.
No doubt.
Into hundreds of thousands of dollars per year of treatment. How would you anticipate, and I know this is perhaps a bit of a premature question, but within the bounds of what you can talk about at this point, how would you anticipate your products will compare once they're on the market, assuming that, of course, that they are eventually approved?
Yeah, from a cost perspective, no question they'll be much less expensive. It's way cheaper to grow up cells in culture at a mass scale than it is to manufacture an antibody, for example. So there's no question that there's a huge cost advantage. The other thing I can say is that we've been, in the trials that we're running now, we have been careful about, I mentioned earlier about combination immunotherapy being the wave of the future. We've been cautious about combining with other immunotherapies that are very expensive, because we may have a great cost advantage, but as soon as you now are tied to something that's really expensive, you've lost that advantage for patients.
Sure.
So for example, in our lung cancer trial, we're combining with low dose cyclophosphamide, which is commercially available, very inexpensive agent that allows us to preserve that cost effectiveness. In bladder cancer, we're combining with BCG, which is the standard of care. It's probably the longest standing example of immunotherapy. It's also very inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be announcing actually this quarter the opening of another trial where we're going to be looking at lots of other different combinations of our agent with different things. And while I'm not going to promise that you won't see combinations with something that's expensive, you'll also see other combinations with things that are more cost effective. And that's really an important part of our approach to try to maintain that cost effectiveness as, I mean, I think everyone's aware of the huge burden on our healthcare system. And you know, we want to try to be very cognizant of that.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned the ability to scale up and mass produce these products. Is that an ongoing part of the process in your company? I mean, is that already being worked on?
It is. And one of the distinguishing factors between how we operate versus some other companies, particularly the autologous companies who do their own manufacturing, we actually work with external partners, contract manufacturing organizations. We're working with, you know, the best in the world that have, you know, a lot of cell therapy experience.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, while we have team in-house who manages that group, it's not our intention at the moment to develop our own manufacturing capabilities, but to work through external providers to scale up our processes.
I see. And these products actually use, I understand, laboratory tumor cell lines.
Yep.
So these are all existing cell lines. So
they
you're
are.
Not having to reinvent the cell line wheel, as it were.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to get you to talk a little bit more for us about this heat shock protein GP96, which is a really fascinating element. And you've referred to, your company refers to this as the immune system's Swiss Army knife. Tell us more about GP96.
Yeah, so it's a chaperone. And basically what that means is it helps essentially all other proteins fold. And a protein's function is based on its proper folding. So its job is to help other proteins fold so that they can do their thing, basically. The other thing that I mentioned about GP96 earlier is how its presence outside the cell basically triggers the flip of this switch on the immune system. That's the adjuvant capability of GP96. So adjuvant is basically... has two meanings in the oncology world. In the context of vaccines, adjuvant means something that basically presents whatever you're presenting to the immune system. So GP96 is that method of presenting antigens, proteins, that mm-hmm. it's helping fold
okay.
to the immune system. And so it's kind of got a dual role in that case. So by pumping it out, a lot of vaccines that have just a single protein antigen, they have to add something external, an external adjuvant that gets those antigens to the immune system. Whereas GP96 itself is the adjuvant. It's the natural adjuvant. So when we say Swiss Army knife, it basically means it's got multiple tools in its pocket.
Indeed. I understand that part of the advantage here is that this impact platform, so-called, severs the leash, you know, by genetically modifying tumor cells that bind GP96 to the endoplasmic reticulum, and
yes.
I'm proud that I can even pronounce that.
That's impressive.
along with the chaperone antigens.
Yeah, so when I mentioned that sort of the secret sauce is GP96 being pumped out of the cell, it is that the severing of the leash at one end of the protein that was the mechanism by which that invention occurred. So GP96 is normally tethered inside the cell on the ER, as you mentioned, and is normally only expressed outside the cell when that cell bursts, and now it's not stuck inside the ER anymore, mm-hmm. endoplasmic reticulum.
Right.
And the way that it's stuck is on one end of the protein, it had a 4 amino acid sequence, KDEL. We call that the leash that leashes it to the endoplasmic reticulum. We've replaced that with a secretory sequence so that now GP96 is no longer attached to the ER, and now it can be pumped out. So that's the underlying technology, is the replacement of that little sequence so that GP96 can now be secreted from the cells as opposed to being stuck inside.
I see. Well explained. Thank you for that.
Yeah, sure.
Because it's a fascinating concept, but it takes a little bit to wrap your mind around it.
No doubt.
You are listening to Radio In Vivo, and my guest today is Dr. Melissa Price from Heat Biologics Incorporated. And we are discussing the company's very promising approach to cancer immunotherapy, also known as immuno-oncology. Melissa, now that we have kind of a handle on the general approach you're taking at Heat Biologics and why it has such great potential, let's take a look at the two drug candidates that you have that are farthest along in their development.
Great.
HS-110, which is intended to treat non-small cell lung cancer,
yep.
and HS-410 for bladder cancer. Now, tell us first about HS-110. Where does it stand at this point in its development?
HS-110 is in phase 2. It's in a randomized controlled phase 2 trial right now,
mm-hmm.
Being run in the U.S. and Australia. looking at patients who have received at least two prior lines of therapy. And patients are randomized either to HS-110, our therapy. The long mouthful word is Viagen Pimatacel L. You may see that written as well.
Okay.
In combination with, as I mentioned, low-dose cyclophosphamide. And I talked a little bit about combination immunotherapy and needing to both put on the accelerator and take off the brake. We believe our technology is pushing the accelerator. Low-dose cyclophosphamide, as well as checkpoint inhibitors that I mentioned, such as the newly approved pembrolizumab and nivolumab, they take off the brake. And so low-dose cyclophosphamide is another one of those mechanisms of taking off the brake. So we've tested it in phase one by itself, had a great safety profile, no serious adverse events for any of the patients,
mm-hmm.
And are now looking at combining that with low-dose cyclophosphamide and randomizing patients against physician's choice, meaning in this setting, there is nothing approved for this population of patients. And so they've gotten two prior lines of therapy, and the physician gives them any one of a number of single-agent chemotherapies as a to try. And they're all equally minimally effective. And so because there's not really a gold standard, we're allowing physicians to choose which of this standard list do you think is best for this individual patient if they do indeed get randomized to that arm in the trial.
I see. So that's the control arm.
That's the control arm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's also a very interesting approach.
Yeah.
Well, non-small cell lung cancer, for those who may not be intimately familiar with it, it's a pretty prevalent form of the disease. According to what I have, there's 225,000 new cases annually and 156,000 deaths in 2014 in the U.S.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And it's difficult to treat as well. So, you know, I understand, and you've mentioned it yourself, that the standard in oncology is extending life, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not, and I understand your hesitation to use the word cure.
It's a big word.
It's a big word, and it's not to be thrown around lightly.
Yeah.
But it seems like a treatment like this offers, you know, substantial extension of life at worst.
Yeah, and you know, the data in our phase two is obviously still being generated. I can speak a little bit about what we saw in phase one.
Okay.
You know, you're not really looking for efficacy in a phase one setting. You're really trying to look at safety, and usually these patients are much more advanced than what you would evaluate typically, which mm-hmm. is what we saw.
Sure.
In our phase one study, we treated 18 patients, and the average number of prior treatments was 7, which is a huge number of prior therapies.
Mm-hmm.
What we saw was that the overall survival was more than doubled from the historical data in the entire population. And then if you subdivide those patients into a group that had an immune response in their blood versus those who didn't, so we're treating this almost as a biomarker. The ones who did not have an immune response, their overall survival was pretty consistent with historical data, which is about 4.5 months.
Mm-hmm.
The patients, 73% of the patients did have an immune response in their blood, and their overall survival was 17 months. So a huge extension for the patients who had an immune response to the vaccine. Now, obviously, the holy grail is being able to identify those patients up front.
Sure.
Having said that, if you can detect that early on, even after treatment, you could envision potentially moving a patient who doesn't have an immune response in the blood onto something else, you know, more quickly than you would be able to otherwise. And so those are data we're following up in the phase two and trying to really tease out to try to understand who are the best candidates, who is most likely to respond to our agent.
I see. Very good. Well, it must keep you and your folks just anxious to come to work every day.
It's very exciting.
Watch all this.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about HS-410. which is the bladder cancer
approach.
I understand that that has been granted FDA fast track status, as
it
we
has.
Talked about.
Yeah.
And just to lay the groundwork about bladder cancer, it's stats I've seen most recently were that it's the fifth most common cancer, 75,000 cases diagnosed annually, 16,000 deaths. And I understand that a big part of the problem is also a high rate of recurrence.
That's right.
So tell us about that product and how does it differ from HS-110?
Sure. So from a product perspective, the only real difference between HS-110 and HS-410 is the starting cell line. So HS-110, it's a lung cancer product. It's derived from a lung cancer cell line because it contains the antigen repertoire that represents lung cancer patients and lung cancer tumors, lung tumors. Similarly, with our bladder cancer trial, it's a bladder cancer cell line, and it contains a different matrix of antigens that are believed to be representative of heterogeneous bladder cancer population.
Okay, and that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and you know, any subsequent, you can envision this technology being applied to essentially any indication that you have a cell line that you believe carries a, maybe call it fingerprint of antigens that represents a large heterogeneous patient population. So there's
and that
lots
even
of
goes
options.
Goes beyond cancer as well.
It
I
does
had a
actually.
Question prepared for you a little later, but we're there, so I'll ask it. I understand that there's possibilities that this might work for HIV.
Yep.
And other immune related
malaria. There are, yeah, lots of infectious disease applications as well. You know, that I think over time we'll be able to explore.
And
right now we're focused on oncology, but yeah, the technology has a lot of other applications as well.
Okay. Going back to bladder cancer, because
sure.
we didn't
sorry
really,
about that.
That's okay. We digress. That's fine. Tell us a little bit more about where that drug stands in terms of its development at this point.
Yep. So it is also in phase two. We completed a phase one at the end of last year, and that both the lung cancer and the bladder cancer trial are on roughly the same timelines in terms of completing of enrollment, which will happen by the end of this year, with readouts in 2016. One of the interesting things about the bladder trial is that we get access to quite a bit of tumor tissue from patients.
Mm-hmm.
So the standard way of treating these patients is they come in usually with blood in their urine. That's how they know they have something going on, as opposed to a more, I guess, systemic. You know, they're otherwise rather healthy. They come in with blood in their urine. They find out they have a bladder tumor. It gets resected. We get a piece of that tissue, so we're able to see what are the antigens in the tissue in the tumor before they get treated. Then they come back every 3 months, and this is just part of standard of care. They have a cystoscopy, which is basically a little camera that goes into the bladder to look around. And if they see something suspicious, they'll take another little sample of that, and we'll get a piece of that as well. So we've got an opportunity to look in at the individual tumor tissue in terms of what's happening in response to the therapy, which is something that is not as easy to get to in lung cancer because it's harder to get you know, those specimens.
Sure.
So we actually reported not too long ago some early anecdotal data showing that, I think I mentioned that, you know, being the accelerator, pushing the accelerator on the immune system, what that means is that we're basically generating killer T cells to go kill the cancer. I also mentioned that in our lung phase one study that we saw an immune response in the blood. A lot of people ask us, well, okay, so you can generate T cells in the blood, but how do you know that that actually gets into the tumor? And we hadn't been able to answer that question in patients until very recently, where we were able to show that for one patient in particular, they had a huge increase in the infiltration of these T cells after therapy. And in that particular patient, it also correlated with response, clinical response. So that patient was rendered disease-free at that, you know, correlated with that increase in TIL is what the terminology is, tumor infiltrating lymphocytes.
I see.
So okay. we're generating that phase. Still
that was a eureka moment, I'm sure.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah. It was fantastic because it showed that, A, we could see T cells getting into the tumor. We hadn't been able to show that in humans before. We'd seen it in animals.
Mm-hmm.
And also that the mechanism works in humans, albeit in an anecdotal subset of patients.
Well, there was some proof of concept.
Proof of concept, right. Yeah. That the mechanism is working the way we expected it to based on our animal data. And that's, you know, a really great first step.
Absolutely. So when will either of those drugs enter phase three?
We're targeting
a lot of those questions will start to be answered, I'm sure, in phase three trials.
Yeah, so we're targeting the end of 2016 to start those phase three trials. We're actually in preparations now because it takes a long time to get your manufacturing scale-up done, to have all your countries selected, to mm-hmm. understand what your protocol is going to look like, how it might differ from what you're doing in phase two. So those preparations are actually ongoing as we speak. And so we're looking forward to seeing that data continuing to emerge and to drive our decision making.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I understand that according to your website, you actually have three other oncology drugs in preclinical development at this point. What are they designed for? And do you anticipate that any of them will be entering the clinical phase soon?
Yeah. So I'm not sure I can speak too specifically about the individual agents themselves and the indications. We've got a number of indications that we've been thinking about.
Okay.
The timing of being able to enter into a new product is partly funding dependent. We're a small biotech company, and really to be able to generate, you know, the resources that are needed to be able to push through something else, we need to generate some good proof of concept of what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really how we've been focusing our resources. But what we've been trying to do is to build up this pipeline of preclinical candidates. I can say that they're all targeting solid tumors at the moment, so that we can very rapidly move them into the clinical space when that funding allows. You know, the real inflection point from a spend perspective is when it goes into GMP manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sort of stacking the deck in terms of, you know, some of these other candidates, and it may be a business development deal that helps push one of them through. We've been, you know, working with some groups who may have a particular interest in a certain indication that they would then license that and they would fund taking that through. So that's one potential model.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of different aspects to that pipeline development.
So are those potential compounds based on the IMPACT platform?
Yes.
As well, but just using different combinations?
Different cell line to start, so it would target a different indication.
Right.
But then also, mm-hmm. depending on what that that indication is, you would potentially have a different combination. So, for example, if you were with breast cancer versus ovarian cancer, be a different combination of agents that you would consider. So,
part of this is parlaying the knowledge that's emerged in the last, say, 10 years or so that cancer is actually, you know, not one disease, but literally thousands.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, it's going to be very exciting to watch your company's development as things progress, because, it feels like being on the ground floor of something that could be really huge.
It really does. And it's so rewarding to feel like you could have a real impact on patients that have cancer.
Absolutely. Well, you know, other than the clinical evidence living in the statistics, I did want to ask you if you had any, and you've already given us one, but do you have any other anecdotal success stories that you might be able to share now that these drugs have in fact been tested in humans?
I think one of the things that I'm pretty comfortable saying is that the safety profile that we saw in our lung phase one study has been reproduced, both in the ongoing phase two and in our bladder trial as well. So we've dosed across the portfolio approximately 80 patients, maybe a little bit more than 80 patients, and we've had not a single serious adverse event related to the treatment, which is really remarkable. Normally for, let's say, standard chemotherapy, you're expecting one for every single patient, 100% serious adverse events, and we've had zero related to therapy. So, that's obviously very exciting and certainly something for, that patients can look forward to, I think. There are patients who refuse chemotherapy because the side effects are so horrendous. And so, we're very encouraged by the favorable safety profile that we've seen to date. And obviously we need to generate more data in a bigger population, but very happy with that. We primarily see injection site reactions at the site of the intradermal injection where it's a little bit itchy, maybe raised, red.
Which is very common for any injections.
But not the kind of systemic issues that you see with chemotherapy. So that's been pretty exciting. Other than that, it's real anecdotal. You have some patients who, have come back after treatment and said, I feel really, really great. Will that bear out in terms of tumor burden reduction? That remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. But certainly we're encouraged when, a patient comes in after receiving our therapy and says that they feel good.
Absolutely. How long does it take to start to take some effect?
We don't really know because the data is so immature at this point.
Sure.
From our phase one data, the peak of the immune response we saw was around 12 weeks, so 3 months. There have been anecdotal reports of feeling good, and I'm using air quotes here, earlier than that. Mm-hmm. But I think, we're still evaluating the kinetics of the immune response, and I think it probably will differ by patient as well. Some patients have a robust immune system and respond very quickly. Others may not respond at all because their immune system isn't competent. Mm-hmm. We're still trying to flesh all that out.
Well, it'll be interesting to see down the road at some point if there isn't some further combination that may help boost a patient's immune system.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, Melissa, what are the plans at Heat Biologics at this point for ultimately entering the market? I'm sure you're thinking about these issues already.
Yeah.
Do you plan to license the product, perhaps to Big Pharma? Or are you planning to go it alone to expand and put together your own sales force and marketing team?
Yeah, there are a lot of different strategies and it changes all the time. So what I tell you today may be different in a year from now.
We won't hold you to it.
Okay, good. Our strategy at the moment is to license after phase two. That's really the value inflection point for the company. And it's also where Big Pharma is more comfortable investing. We don't currently anticipate building a huge development and commercialization company.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that could change. The other thing that we're doing is considering regional partnering, I'll just use lung as an example, where we might partner just the lung product for rights in Asia, where we would keep, U.S. and Europe. So there's lots of different ways to skin that cat. Mm-hmm. But I feel pretty confident saying that, licensing after phase two is a strong part of our strategy.
And that's, part of certainly the contemporary business model for so many biotech startups such as yourself.
Yeah.
It's not about building another, Glaxo or Roche or Merck. It's taking advantage of what the infrastructure they have in place.
Exactly.
So, that sounds...
Then we can bring the next greatest thing in,
There you go. Well, Melissa, before we run out of time and we're just about there, what has all this meant to you on a personal level? You've talked about helping people and helping patients. What keeps you motivated every day?
I really want to impact the lives of patients with cancer. I think you'd be hard pressed to find anyone who has not been personally affected by cancer.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a teenager, I thought I wanted to be a physician, and we had a family friend who was 10 years old who died of leukemia. And I said, I don't think I could be a physician because I don't think I could deal with that emotionally every day.
Sure.
I lost my grandmother a few years later to leukemia. And I said, you know, I'm passionate about working with cancer. Is there a way that I can do that in a different way? And I think that has led me to the career decisions that I've made to try to be close to the patient and be able to work on really exciting science. But at the end of the day, I'm motivated to get up every day because I really believe in what we're doing. And there is so much opportunity out there to help patients. And that's what motivates me.
Well, Melissa, it's been just fascinating to learn about your company's very exciting approach to cancer treatment.
Thank you.
We'll be keeping an eye on progress at Heat Biologics. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
It's a pleasure. Well, we've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You could check the website, radioinvivo.net, or our Facebook site for our lineup of upcoming shows. Join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro, and Chapel Hill. And we want to also promote that on May 7th, we are having a fundraiser right next door at the Hickory Tavern here in Carrboro. And that'll be running from 5 to 10 p.m. on Thursday, May 7th. And we hope you will come out and meet your favorite WCOM DJs, myself included, I hope, and help us keep this radio station on the air and thriving. Now stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.